This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I want to thank all of you firstly for attending today. Inshallah, this is going to be the first of many sessions like this. Right? So for those of you all who don't know me, my name is Ismail Kamda, and I've been involved in the field of Islamic studies for 20 years now, since I was 13. So, alhamdulillah. And the subject that we're going to get into over the next 6 weeks is one of my personal favorites, Usul al-Fiqh. But it's also something that in our community, people don't usually talk about. In fact, people aren't even aware of it. You know, when I was marketing this course, at least 70% of the people who I spoke to, when I told them I'm teaching a course in Usul al-Fiqh, their question was, what's that? Right? So the idea that people don't even know what it is means we really need to talk about it and to teach it. So before we get started, just give an idea of why we're doing this, why we started this program. I believe that the best form of education is something that's consistent on a weekly basis. Sometimes we attend weekend seminars on these type of courses, and the weekend seminars are good for an iman boost. They're good for getting a lot of knowledge at once, but it's very hard to sustain that. You may attend a weekend seminar on this topic, but how much of it are you going to remember after 1, 2, or 3 months, or even after 1 or 2 years? Now, when we study something once a week on a consistent basis, then we have more time to digest, right? If we spend 1 hour a week, we have an entire week to digest and remember what we learned. So I'm hoping that with this, this will inshallah be the beginning of many such courses, right? We're just starting with a 6-week course on Usul al-Fiqh. If this goes well, then in January we'll continue with Maqasid al-Sharia, Qawaid al-Fiqhiyya. We're going to many other sciences. This inshallah is going to be the beginning of many such courses like this. So what we're going to do today, I'm going to very briefly explain what to expect over the next 6 weeks, what's the objectives and the reasons for studying the subject, and go over the terminology you need to know to understand the subject. So before we even get into that, I want to just address a point that a lot of people raise, right? Which is, this subject, Usul al-Fiqh, is normally taught to ulama, people who are becoming ulama, right? It's usually taught, like I myself, I teach it in the online university to people who are basically studying to be alims. They're studying to be the next generation of ulama. So a lot of people ask me why I want to teach this to people who are not ulama. They say this is a specific science, it's only for the ulama. Why do you want to teach it to people who are not ulama? And they are afraid that by teaching this subject to people who are not ulama, they are going to start making their own fatwas. Right, that's the fear. If people know these sciences, they're going to make their own fatwas. So before we get into the course objectives, this is what the course objectives are not, or is not. The course objective is not to make you a mufti. Right? 6 weeks or 6 hours of Usul al-Fiqh is not going to give you the capabilities to make your own fatwas. Is that clear? Right? It's just going to give you an idea of how the process works. So let's get that out of the way firstly, right? So what can we expect over the next 6 weeks? Today we're going to focus on the objectives and terminology for two reasons. We're focusing on objectives because if we don't know why we are here, we're not going to benefit, right? So our objectives, that's something we need to be clear about. Why we are here and what we expect to get from this course. Number two, terminology. Whenever you study a new field, any field, not even Islamic fields, even psychology, medicine, anything, any new field, you need to learn the lingo of that field first, right? What's the words they use? What's the terms they use? Because every field of study has its own terminology, right? And so it's the same with Usul al-Fiqh. So there's a lot of words that I'm going to be using over the next 6 weeks, which I prefer to use the Arabic, because it doesn't make sense when you use the English. So today we'll go over what those Arabic words mean. And I actually started off with a list of 20 words. And I'm sitting this afternoon, I'm thinking, it's too much. Too much for day one. People show up on day one, hit them with 20 Arabic words to know the meaning of. It's a bit too much. I managed to bring it down to about 15. Most of them you already know. You just may not know the technical definition. So I try to make this as simple as possible. Right? Next week, very interesting. It's one of my favorite subjects. The history of fiqh. Now in the university, I spend 5 months teaching the history of fiqh. Next week, we're going to attempt to do it in 1 hour. Right? So it's going to be like a brief overview. How did we go from the time of the Prophet ﷺ until now? What were the different stages of development? Most importantly, how did the madhabs come about? And how do we approach the concept of madhabs? All of that will be covered in the history. The week after that, we'll focus on the primary sources of fiqh, which is the Quran and the Sunnah. Right? The Quran and the Sunnah. An entire lesson on how the Quran and Sunnah are used in fiqh, which is something which many people are unaware of. And many people have this idea, you pick a hadith, you follow it. It's not as simple as that. It's a lot more complicated. The week after that, we look at the other two main sources of fiqh, and we'll cover this in the terminology section today, which is ijma and qiyas, right? Consensus and deductive reasoning. So we'll cover that in the fourth week. And the fifth week, I want to focus entirely on one of the main Hanafi principles of fiqh, which is urf, local culture. I want to do an entire lesson on this, because urf, local culture, is a principle of fiqh that's found in all the mazhabs under different names, but it's most important in the Hanafi mazhab. But somehow we got it all wrong. I mean, we are Hanafi community, but we went far away from this principle, you know. Urf is about, what urf basically means, what Imam Abu Hanifa taught, is that whenever people move to a country, they should adapt to the culture of that country. They should not impose their culture upon the country they are moving to. That was the teaching of Imam Abu Hanifa. So we went off there, very far off. So that's why an entire lecture, number 5, is going to be about that. And number 6, we'll go into whatever's left, some of the Maliki principles, some of the Hanbali principles, the ones that there's differences of opinion over. So primarily, this is Hanafi usul al-fiqh that we're focusing on. Quran, Sunnah, Ijma, Qiyas, and Urf. And we will discuss the others as well. I'm focusing on the Hanafi ones mainly because that's the predominant madhab in our community. So, to get started, why are we here? Before I answer that, anybody wants to give me an idea, what do you expect to get from a course on Usul al-Fiqh? What are you hoping to get out of a course on Usul al-Fiqh? Anyone? Like I said, I'm not here to make you muftis. Right, so if you came here hoping that by the end of this course you can pick up a hadith and pass your own fatwas, not going to happen. Right? What you're going to learn in these 6 weeks is that this process is so complicated that if you really want to do it, you need to go get your bachelor's in Islamic studies, get your master's, get your PhD, you work your way up. Right? Not 6 weeks isn't going to be enough. Okay, the first thing I want us to get out of this is to appreciate just how complex fiqh is. Many people don't appreciate this. Right? A lot of people, they say, but you know, Islam is simple. You know, I can just pick a hadith and follow it. And why are you making it complicated? Why are you introducing this terminology? Why are you bringing in this and that? You know, so fiqh is not complicated. Fiqh is not complicated in terms of practice, but in terms of how it's deduced, how the scholars arrive at it, there is complexity there. And I'll answer this question a bit later today, because a lot of people find this like a contradiction. On one hand, we say Islam is easy. On the other hand, the sciences are so complicated. Now, how do we reconcile between those two concepts? Islam is an easy religion, and we'll actually quote the verses about that towards the end. So why is this subject so complicated? That I will discuss towards the end today, inshallah. So one of the main things I want us to do after this course is just to be able to appreciate just how complicated this field is, so we can at least recognize the people in the field. You know, there are people out there. You know, I know so many ulama who spend time, they spend months researching a topic, and when they finally arrive at the conclusion and they post it on Facebook, people tell them, you are kafir, you are deviant, you are liberal, you this, you that. No appreciation for the amount of effort that goes in just trying to figure out what is the actual ruling on this thing. So at least to be able to appreciate it. The second thing, and this is very important, right? To understand the aspects of fiqh that are flexible and the parts of fiqh that are not. So, again, we have these two opposite trends in our community. We have those people who think everything's flexible, right? Anything goes, change the rules, how you want, when you want. And then we have the other side of our community where, you know, if some sheikh in India said something 300 years ago, we have to stick to that until Qiyamah. Fiqh is a balance. There's certain things that change, certain things that don't change. Once you study this field, it becomes clear what changes and what doesn't. Right? Number 3, I already mentioned this. Appreciate the ulama. The ulama who actually use these principles and arrive at these conclusions and do this work. once you understand how complicated and complex this process is, we can have some appreciation for them, even when we don't agree with them. Even when we don't agree with them, we still appreciate the fact that they went through this process to arrive at their conclusions. Number four, whenever I teach fiqh or maqasid or qawaid or any of these similar topics, I feel overwhelmed with a sense of yaqeen, conviction in Islam. Because the more I study and teach the subject, the more I am convinced that this religion is a miracle. It's truly a miracle. Because when you look at man-made systems of law, within 50 to 100 years they are outdated. Right? I mean, just go back 50 years ago to the laws people came up with. We can't even imagine using those same laws today. Right? And you're talking about laws that came from secularism, from democracy, from humanism, from communism. We can't even imagine using the same laws 50 years later. With Islam, it's 1,400 years. And all of this is still practical. It's so practical and so deep that there is absolutely no way that a human being in the middle of the desert 1,400 years ago, who was unable to read or write, invented this system of law. It had to come from God. So at the very least, this course should put into our hearts this yaqeen that this has to be from Allah. There's no other way that such a beautiful, deep system came about in the desert 1,400 years ago unless Allah revealed it. Very important. One of the main reasons why I want our community to learn Usulul Fiqh is that we become tolerant to each other's opinions. Right? So, we as a community, there are a lot of us who have very diverse opinions. And sometimes most of the time, we tend to fight too much about it. Right? We fight too much about our differences of opinion. And when you study Usulul Fiqh and you learn how the scholars work out fiqh, how one person arrived at one conclusion and someone else arrived at the opposite conclusion, and they are both sincere and they are both pious and they both sincerely believe in what they are saying, you become a lot more tolerant to these issues than someone who just learned a specific worldview and nothing else. So this should make us more tolerant and more accepting to the fact that there is a diverse field of opinions in many things, many areas of fiqh. And finally, I want us to understand how differences of opinion are formed, why they are formed, and also to understand why they are to be expected, why it's a natural thing. Again, many young people who have an absolutist idea about Islam, they have this thing, but you know, we have one Quran, one Hadith, there should be only one Madhab. Right? That's their mindset. There's one Quran, one Hadith, we should all have the same opinions. So the Quran and Hadith are one, yes. But how humans interpret and understand the Quran and Hadith, that is diverse. It is extremely diverse, not from now, from the time of the Sahaba. Next week when we look at the history of fiqh, you will see that the Sahaba had completely opposite understandings of fiqh from each other. The way Abdullah ibn Mas'ud radiallahu anhu approached fiqh, and the way Abdullah ibn Umar radiallahu anhu approached fiqh were polar opposites. Literally on opposite ends to each other in how they approach this topic. From the beginning, the ulama amongst the Sahaba had different approaches and arrived at different conclusions. So differences of opinion is a natural part of people trying to implement Islam in their lives. Okay, so those are our course objectives. Now, the main part of today's discussion is for us to learn the basic terms in this field. And I want to start off with two terms, fiqh and sharia. If I ask you to tell me in one or two words, what is the meaning of sharia? Just two words, anyone. Two word definition of sharia. How we often translate it? Islamic law. Fiqh? Jurisprudence. What else? A lot of people translate it as Islamic law. Am I right? Okay, raise your hands if you believe fiqh and sharia refer to two different things. Raise your hand if you believe fiqh and sharia are the same thing. Raise your hand if you have no clue. Okay, good. So it's good I brought these two up as the first two terms. Fiqh and sharia. Sharia is the revealed explicit law that all Muslims agree upon and cannot be changed. Fiqh is the human understanding and interpretation of the sharia subject to differences of opinions and change. So, very big difference. Sharia, number one, it's revelation. And fiqh is understanding. In fact, the word fiqh means to understand. Right? The word fiqh means to understand, like in the hadith, an Muawiyah radiallahu anhu qala Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, may yuridillahu bi khayran yufaqihu fi deen. Muawiyah radiallahu anhu narrated that the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, whoever Allah wants good for, He gives him the understanding of the religion. The verb used there is yufaqihu. It's the verb form of this noun, fiqh. Right? So, Sharia is revealed, fiqh is understood. Sharia is agreed upon, fiqh is subject to difference of opinion. Sharia is unchangeable, fiqh is changeable. Let's look at an example. An example of Sharia, there are 5 daily salah. Is there any madhab that says there are 6 or 7 or 4 or 3 daily salah? No. There are 5 daily salah. It is in the revelation, it is agreed upon, it's unchangeable. It's not at some point in the future where people will say, well, you know what, our technology has gone so advanced, we only need to pray 3 times a day now. Right? Or the ummah state is so bad now, we have to make 7 salah wajib on them. And you can't change it. This is unflexible, it's agreed upon, it's revealed. Human understanding and interpretation, that's subject to difference of opinion. Where do you place your hands in salah? Right? Hanafis say, yeah. Shafi'i say, yeah. Maliki say, there. What's this? This is different understandings and interpretation of the Sharia. What is the Sharia? We pray Salatul Fajr. Right? That is Sharia. What is the understandings? Where do I place my hands? Do I read Bismillah loud or quietly? Do I say the Ameen loud or quietly? Do I raise my hands before and after ruku? This is the Sharia. This is fiqh. These are different understandings of the Sharia. They are subject to difference of opinion. Fiqh is also subject to change. Classical examples of that would be in the time of Umar radiallahu anhu. For anyone who's familiar with the biography of Umar ibn al-Khattab radiallahu anhu, he changed a lot of laws during his khilafat. Right? And from that we learn this entire process of changing laws when it's necessary. For example, the law of amputating the hand of a thief. In the time of Umar radiallahu anhu, there was a point in time where there was a drought, and there was mass poverty and starvation. So during that period, he suspended the law of amputating the hand of the thief. Now, note he did not change the Sharia. He did not say this law never applies again until the end of time. He didn't say that. He simply said for these years, while there is mass poverty, there is mass starvation, people have an excuse for stealing, people are dying, for these years, we will not apply this law. Once the situation is lifted, we go back to applying the law. So this shows us that even though the Sharia says that the hand of the thief is amputated, but fiqh allows us to not apply this in certain situations. Right? Fiqh allows us to apply it sometimes and not apply it sometimes depending on the situation. So fiqh is subject to change. And that change can come either with a new evidence, with a new circumstance, with a new culture. There's many different things that affect why our fiqh will change. And we'll come to that as we look at some of the other terms today. Term number 3, the big one, what we are discussing today. Usulul fiqh. So as I said, when I was telling people I'm going to start teaching a class on usulul fiqh, number one question I got, what's that? Never heard of it. I never heard of it. Right? So usul, which is the plural of asal, it means a principle or a foundation. It means like a root. That which everything else comes out of. And when you talk about usul al-fiqh or usul al-tafsir or usul al-hadith, we are talking about, there's 3 translations for it. In terms of fiqh, we can translate it as principles governing fiqh, the methodology of arriving at fiqh, or the foundations of fiqh. Right? So, what this means is that, again, a misconception people have, that ulama just pull up fatwas from their pockets. You know, they just look around like, you know, this is haram, 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 this is haram. That's not how fiqh works. Right? You don't just pull fatwas out. There is a process of methodology, of a set of principles that ulama follow, and using those principles, they formulate their opinions. Right? So these principles are called the usul al-fiqh. And that takes us to another important word. What's a mazhab? What's a mazhab? Right? We always hear people talking about the different mazhabs. Well, the madhab, when you actually go back to it, it's simply a school of fiqh revolving around a specific set of usul. So what this means, if we look at this next week when we study the history of fiqh, very early on in our history, the ulama had differences of opinion on how do we approach fiqh. And these differences of opinion on how we approach fiqh, they became the usul al-fiqh, the methodology of fiqh. And certain scholars who had their own methodologies of fiqh became more famous than others, and basically a school of thought developed around that. Right? Just to go right back to the very beginning, before the madhabs that we know about, at the very beginning we can say there were two madhabs, the Ahlul Roy and the Ahlul Hadith. The scholars who looked at things from a perspective of why and context and what did he mean, and the people who just took the word literally. Right? So for example, when the Prophet ﷺ said something, the one group of ulama would take what he said and follow it. The other group of ulama will take what he said, understand why did he say it, what's the context, was it for everybody, was it only for one person, what's the purpose of what he's saying. They will analyze it from a variety of angles and then arrive at their conclusion. Right? So we see this, for example, when the Sahaba were told by the Prophet ﷺ, when they were going to Banu Qurayda, the army was marching towards Banu Qurayda, the Prophet ﷺ told them, none of you should pray Salatul Asr until you get there. None of you should pray Salatul Asr until you get there. So as they're marching, they're still a distance away from the destination, and Asr time is about to end. So one half of the Sahaba said, the Prophet said, don't pray till you get there, we're not going to pray till we get there, even if it becomes Qada. We're following his exact literal word. The other half of the Sahaba said, that's not what he meant. He meant, hurry up and get there fast. We still have to pray Asr on time. So half the Sahaba stopped, they prayed Asr on time. The other half continued, they prayed Asr late. The Prophet ﷺ did not say anything bad towards either of them. He did not condemn the opinion of either of them. He let it go. Showing us from the very beginning, one half of the Sahaba followed what the Prophet said literally, the other half of the Sahaba looked at, what did he mean? So these became the two madhabs, Ahlul Roy, Ahlul Hadith. Over time, these developed further. From the Ahlul Hadith, we got the Shafi'i and the Hanbali and the Zahiri madhabs. From the Ahlul Roy, we got the Maliki, the Hanafi, the Auza'i, the Asawri, and many other madhabs. So they began to split in different directions. Over time, certain madhabs disappeared, certain madhabs grew more popular. Today in the world, we have three madhabs that are dominant, the Hanafi, the Maliki, and the Shafi'i. The Hanbali madhab also still exists, as does the Zaydi madhab, but they are minority madhabs today. So when we talk about the madhab, we're talking about the usul al-fiqh. How do they approach fiqh? It doesn't mean that everybody following this madhab has the same fiqh opinions, right? So for example, Imam Abu Hanifa and his students had differences of opinion with each other. For example, you know, nowadays we say, for Asr, we say we have Shafi time and Hanafi time, right? What we call Shafi time was actually Asr time, even according to Imam Abu Hanifa's students. Meaning, even in the Hanafi madhab, there is a school of thought that say Asr time starts earlier. Right? So they follow the same principle as Imam Abu Hanifa, but they may have arrived at different conclusions. They considered part of his madhab, not because they had the same conclusions as him, but because they had the same principles as him. So when we study usul al-fiqh, we are looking at how do a group of scholars approach fiqh. Ash-Shafi'i had one method. Imam Malik had a different method. Imam Abu Hanifa had a different method. Ahmad ibn Hanbal had a different method. Ibn Hazm had a different method. Sufyan al-Thawri had a different method. There were all different methods that existed, and these became the different madhabs. Okay, very briefly, the next few terms, I'm not going to go to them in detail because we have entire lectures on them, right? We have lecture number 4 on Ijma' and Qiyas, so we'll cover it there. Just now, you know the translation. Ijma' means consensus of the scholars. Right? I want to discuss this in details in 3 weeks' time because this term it's abused nowadays. You know, nowadays whenever someone wants to force something on you, they'll say there's ijma on it. Even when there's no ijma on it. Right? What ijma simply means, it means something that there's no difference of opinion about. For example, there is ijma that there are 5 daily salah. There is ijma that zina is haram. Right? Is there any difference of opinion about that? No. So the Arabic term for this is ijma, a consensus. There is no difference of opinion. It's not like you can interpret the verses differently. The fourth term that we need to know about is qiyas. So essentially, the four main madhabs, they agree on four usul al-fiqh. Quran, Sunnah, Ijma, and qiyas. These are the four that they agree upon. Some of the other madhabs don't agree upon qiyas, like the Zahiri madhab don't accept qiyas. We'll cover them when you do the history next week. But the four main madhab do. So there's an agreement there between the four madhabs. And what this is, qiyas is how we approach new issues. Right? Something that didn't exist in the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. How do we figure out the ruling on drugs, on pornography, on the internet, on social media, on cigarettes, on all these different things? How do we figure out the rulings? They're not listed in the Quran, they're not listed in the Hadith. We use a process called qiyas. Qiyas means you take a principle or a maxim, which we'll come to a bit later, that you extracted from the Quran and Sunnah, and you use it to arrive at a ruling for a new thing. Right? So, something new is invented. How do we know if this new thing is halal or haram? We use qiyas. That's the methodology of the scholars to arrive at. So what you're going to find is that there are, throughout our history, thousands of fiqh issues which are not explicitly mentioned in the Quran or Hadith. Right? On these issues, the Sahaba made qiyas, as did the scholars in the generation after them, and the scholars in the generation after them. And so it became a principle of fiqh. Now, at the time of the Sahaba, they did not call it qiyas. This word was invented later on, but the principle was there. Like we saw in the case of Umar, when he did not allow them to chop off the hands of thieves during that period. That didn't happen in the time of the Prophet ﷺ. There wasn't a verse of the Quran or Hadith he was following there. This was his qiyas, his deductive reasoning based on a principle from the Sharia. The next term, which I'm going to use a lot, this is a Hanafi principle, and that is urf, local culture. Right? So all four of the madhabs agree on a maxim of fiqh called al-adat muhakkama, which translates as the local culture is the deciding factor. Meaning whenever there's a clash of cultures, you follow the local culture. Right? This is agreed upon by all the madhabs. The Hanafi madhab have a specific name for it called urf, the Hanafi and the Maliki madhabs. Okay, very important term. Ijtihad. It's going to come up a lot, especially when we discuss the history of fiqh, because this became a controversy in the past 300 years. When we talk about the word ijtihad, it simply means a scholar's effort to figure out the correct ruling on an issue. So you phone up an alim, and you ask him, Sheikh, what's the fatwa on this? He checks the Quran, he checks the Hadith, he looks at the books of Ijma, he looks at the opinions of the Imams, he looks at the opinions of the Sahaba, he uses Qiyas, he looks at the culture, he looks at the maxims and the maqasid, he looks at all of these things. And if he's pious and he's a good scholar, he makes dua and he asks Allah to guide him and he reads the Hajjud. And then he gives you the fatwa. Right? This whole process is called ijtihad. Right? So ijtihad comes from the same root as the word jihad. Jihad means to strive in the path of Allah. Ijtihad means to strive to figure out what's the ruling on this issue. Right? So it's like, this is the scholar's jihad. When you ask him a question, he's going to have sleepless nights for weeks trying to figure out how to answer that question. Right? In a way that's pleasing to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So when we talk about ijtihad and mujtahid, this is simply what we're speaking about. Two more terms, and inshallah, if this goes well, next year we'll do an entire 6 weeks on each of these two terms. But for now, we just need to know what they mean, because they are related. They're not usul al-fiqh, they are related to usul al-fiqh. Right? Inshallah, we'll do this next year in details. The first one is the qawaid al-fiqhiyah. And at the university, I teach an entire course on this at the online university. The maxims of fiqh. So when we study the history next week, you'll learn that in the later part of our history, to make ijtihad and qiyas easier, the ulama invented these short formulas for fiqh. Short formulas for fiqh. If you learn these short formulas, you can immediately work out the rulings for thousands of issues. Example of a short formula of fiqh, the ulama stated, al-aslu fil ashyai al-ibaha. The original rule for anything is, it is permissible. So this is a maxim of fiqh. Someone asks you, is halal or haram? Well, the original ruling of things is, it's permissible. So unless you bring proof that it's haram, it's halal. Right? So this is a maxim of fiqh. On the opposite side, right, ad-daru yudal, harm must be eliminated. So someone asks you, is this halal? And you know it's harmful. No, it's haram, because harm must be eliminated. Right? So to make this whole complicated process of ijtihad and fiqh easier, the later day ulama, and this happened mainly during the Ottoman era, they invented the qawaid al-fiqhiyah, which makes fiqh very easy, right, for the ulama. Because you just need to memorize these 20 or 30 sentences, and you can work out each sentence literally gives you the answer to thousands of issues. Right, thousands of issues. So another example of a maxim of fiqh would be what we mentioned earlier about al-adat muhakkama, the local culture is the deciding factor. So for example, people come and they're arguing, you know, we're giving a lecture in the masjid this week. You know, the Mulana wants to give it in Urdu. We want him to give it in English. This person wants him to give it in Arabic. What do we do? Local culture is the deciding factor. What do the majority of people coming to the masjid speak? English? Give it in English. Right? That's the local culture. Right? And that's a very simplistic argument, but this maxim applies to many other things. How we dress, what type of food we eat, how do we shake hands with each other. Many different things are guided by local culture. Right? And so this is the maxim governing it. So when you hear me say the qawaid al-fiqhiyah or the maxim of fiqh, I'm talking about these short, simple sentences. These, they call them fiqh formulas that you use when you're trying to figure out fiqh. And the ulama have to memorize these formulas, because if you don't memorize these formulas, which are like 40 or 50 formulas, instead you have to memorize literally thousands of rules. So what's easier, memorizing 40 sentences or memorizing thousands of rules? Right? So these are called the qawaid al-fiqhiyah. Finally, my favorite field of Islamic studies, which inshallah we'll discuss next year, the maqasid al-sharia, the goals and objectives of Islamic law. This also developed mainly in the past 600 years during the Ottoman era. So what we find in the second half of our history is, usul al-fiqh was already written, fiqh was already written, what did the ulama need to do? So they start writing on new topics. So they start writing on the maxim, they start writing on the maqasid, they start developing new topics to write about. Right? And maqasid goes even further back. We have maqasid writings by Al-Ghazali, by Ibn al-Qayyim, by Ibn Taymiyyah, rahimahullah, all of them. But you know, the actual name and field came about more in the past 600 years. So to understand what maqasid is, just to put it in a context, fiqh is what we do. Right? Fiqh is what the ruling is. Usulul fiqh is how we figure out the ruling. Maqasid is why did we arrive at that ruling. So the maqasid is the goals of the sharia. So an example of the maqasid is that human life must be protected. That's why murder is prohibited. Right? And many other rules are related to that. An example of the maqasid is that honor must be protected. That's why we don't commit zina, to protect our honor. Right? An example of the maqasid is that harm, that the sharia was revealed to remove anything harmful from our lives. This is actually Ibn Ashur, the great Maliki scholar, he stated there's two main goals of the sharia, two main maqasid. And all of the sharia revolve around these two goals. The first one is to benefit us, to benefit humanity, to facilitate things that are beneficial for us. The second goal is to remove from our lives anything that is harmful. So the scholars of Maqasid say that every single rule in Islam either brings something beneficial into your life or it keeps something harmful out of your life. Right? When we pray five times a day, the salah, this benefits us. Right? When we give zakah, it benefits us and the other person. It benefits us by removing from our hearts that miserliness and greed. It benefits the other person, he's getting money. Right? When we stay away from zina, we are protecting ourselves from all of the harms that come along with it. When we stay away from alcohol, we are protecting ourselves from all of the harms that come along with it. Right? So these are the two main goals of the sharia. Benefit and avoidance of harm. So that's it for the main terms. I just have one more slide to share. Actually, it's one more set of terms to share with you, but these are the easy terms. Right? What's coming next are the easy words you already know. Just their proper technical definition. But before we do that, these last two terms we looked at, the qawaid and the maqasid, these are fields of study on their own. And if this goes well, then inshallah next year we will do maybe 6 weeks on each of them. 6 weeks on the qawaid, 6 weeks on the maqasid, because they deserve to be studied in more details. These are things that the deeper you go into this field, the more convinced you become that this is truly a miracle from Allah. There is no way that one human being in the desert 1,400 years ago received such a complex sharia. Okay. The final set of terminology is related to how we label things in fiqh. So fiqh essentially, usul al-fiqh essentially is about putting things into boxes. Right? According to the Shafi, Maliki and Hanbali madhabs, there are 5 boxes. And according to the Hanafi madhab, there are 7 boxes. Right? So we look at the 5 first and then we look at the other 2, the 2 extra ones later. And these 5 boxes, you all know them, but you may not be aware of their technical definitions. These 5 boxes, number 1, fard or wajib. So, the scholars have to decide what is fard or wajib, what is mustahab, or the other word for it, sunnah, what is halal, what is makruh, what is haram. The problem nowadays is that many of us may not be aware of the exact technical definition of these terms. So starting off with fard or wajib. Now in the Hanafi mazhab, these are 2 separate categories. But in the other 3 mazhabs, they are synonyms. Right? If a Shafi or a Maliki or Hanbali scholar says wajib, he means fard. Because these are synonyms in most of the mazhabs. It's only, and we look at this in the next slide, 2 separate categories in the Hanafi mazhab. So when we say something is fard or wajib, we mean you have to do it. It's an obligation. And this means 2 things. If you do it, Allah will reward you. If you don't do it, that's a sin. Classical example, praying Salatul Fajr. You pray Salatul Fajr, Allah gives you reward. You don't pray Salatul Fajr, you committed a major sin. Right? So that's a fard. 2nd category, sunnah or mustahab. Recommended. Right? If you do it, Allah will give you a reward. If you don't do it, no problem. And this is again an area where many of us tend to be a bit extreme, right? You know, sometimes we see someone who is not fulfilling a sunnah and we're like, astaghfirullah, he's not doing the sunnah. No, relax, he's not doing anything haram. It's not a sin for him not to be doing the sunnah. And of course, sunnah has different meanings. We come to the other meaning of sunnah when we study Quran and sunnah as usul fiqh. So sunnah as a fiqh category has a different meaning from sunnah as an usul fiqh. Right? It's a bit complicated there. Here we're talking about the label you put on the thing, that you say eating with your right hand is sunnah. That's a fiqh category, meaning there's reward for doing it. Right? When we talk about sunnah as usulul fiqh, we are saying we follow Quran and sunnah. That means we follow whatever the Prophet ﷺ taught. That's a different meaning of the word altogether. So remember, words have different meanings in different fields. So just as word sunnah alone, it has different meanings in fiqh and in usulul fiqh. That's why to make it easier, in fiqh we use the word mustahab instead. So we know what we're referring to. Mustahab simply means it's recommended. It's good to do it. If you don't do it, no problem. Number 3, halal. Or the other term for halal, mubah. Something that's permissible. If something is halal, if you do it, no reward. If you don't do it, no sin. Right? And this is the majority of things in this world. The maxim I mentioned earlier, the original state of anything is permissibility. Right? So, when we work out fiqh, we begin in the middle, at halal. And then if our evidence takes us up or down, we move towards the other categories. If not, it stays halal. Right? If there's evidence to show it's mustahab or farm, the fatwa will go that way. If there's evidence to show that it's makruh haram, the fatwa will go that way. Otherwise, the default ruling of anything is that it's halal. Right, so you don't need a scholar to tell you, you know, is it permissible for me to buy a laptop? Is it permissible for me to own a phone? Is it permissible for me to drive a car? Is it permissible for me to use a pen? Is it permissible for me to rent a house? Is it permissible for me to, you know, invent new technology? No, everything's halal unless there's evidence to prove otherwise. Right, this is part of the simplicity of the Sharia. 80% of the things of this world are in the middle category. Category number 4 is actually the first 4 categories, all of them, you can see are different types of halal. So something that's fard is halal, something that mustahab is halal. Many people don't understand this. Something that's makruh is also halal. Because what's the definition of makruh? Makruh means, if you do it, not a sin. If you avoid it, you get the reward. That's the technical fiqh definition of makruh, disliked. When you say something is makruh, for example, most of the madhabs agree it's makruh to have bad breath when you go to the masjid or meet people. Is it a sin to have bad breath? No. But will you be rewarded if you make an effort to make your breath smell nice? Yes. You'll be rewarded for it. right? Because you are avoiding the makruh. So again, sometimes we have this, we see someone doing something that's makruh, and we get all like, you know, angry with them and upset with them and fight with them. Relax, he's not doing anything haram. Like, there's no sin for doing it. And finally, South African's favorite word, haram. Right? You know, the usul al-fiqh is everything's halal until proven to be haram. But in South Africa, we went the opposite direction. We said everything's haram until, you know, you bring me proof that it's halal. But this category, you know, the early ulama were so scared of using the word haram. Like when you read Imam Malik's books, most of his fatwas are like this. I don't like it. I don't think it's good. I don't think that's good for people. It's not beneficial. It's not nice. He would almost never use the word haram. Why? Because haram means Allah has prohibited it. So unless there is categorical proof in the Quran or Hadith or from the Usul al-Fiqh or the Maqasid that this is something that Allah would prohibit, Allah has prohibited, the ulama were very scared to use this word. They would rather say, I don't like it. Or I don't think it's a good idea. Or, you know, this is borderline haram. It's, you know, it's in the gray area. But they wouldn't use the word haram unless they had evidence for it. And this takes us to why the Hanafis, to deal with this problem, they invented another category of fiqh. Right? So, what happens now is there are certain things which we believe are prohibited or obligatory, but we don't really have a strong evidence for it. Right? So, to deal with this problem, the Hanafi madhab added two more categories of fiqh. Wajib and makruh tahrimi. So what's the difference in the Hanafi madhab between a fard and a wajib and a makruh tahrimi and haram? It's just a matter of evidence. How strong is the evidence? Right? The classic example, the witr salah. The witr salah in the Maliki, Shafi and Hanbali madhabs is sunnah. It's mustahab. It's recommended. Right? In the Hanafi madhab, it's wajib. Why? Why does the Hanafi madhab make it an obligation? Well, there is a hadith. There is an evidence that indicates that witr is something you have to pray. But it's not the strongest level of hadith. It's not like, you know, that level of hadith where you're 100% sure. It's like the 80% to 90% sure type of hadith. So, there's different grades of hadith. This is like what we would call a grade B hadith, not a grade A hadith. And because this hadith exists, but because it's not that level of authentic, the other madhabs ignored it. They said it's sunnah. And the Hanafi madhab said, it's not fard, it's not as compulsory as the other five salah, which we got clear in the Quran and the authentic hadith. It's wajib. Meaning, it's an obligation, but the evidence making it an obligation is not 100%, you know, clear. Right? So there is a possibility that it's not an obligation. The same thing with haram. What happens if you want to say something's haram, but you don't really have clear evidence for it? Like I say, Imam Malik will just say, I don't like it. Or it's not good. Imam Abu Hanifa added an extra category to fiqh, which is, it's makruh tahrimi. It's disliked to the level of prohibition. So again, what's the difference between makruh tahrimi and haram? Just a matter of how strong is the evidence. Right? So for example, a lot of the Hanafi ulama, and I don't agree with this, but a lot of the Hanafi ulama say that smoking cigarettes is makruh tahrimi. Why? Because it clearly has the qualities of something haram, but there's no clear evidence making it haram. My perspective is it's haram. I say it's haram because adoru yudal, we must eliminate harm from our lives. And there's no good in it, there's only harm in it. Right? And there are much less harmful things which are already haram. So I'm of the opinion that it's haram. But you'll find a lot of the ulama will say it's makruh tahrimi for a very simple reason. There's no verse in the Quran or hadith saying that it's haram. So they want to say we can't do it, but without saying it's haram, so we added an extra category. So these two extra categories you find in the Hanafi madhab are simply a matter of evidence. It's a way of solving a problem. What do we do with issues where this is our conclusion, but our evidence is not that strong? So they added a category that's slightly below haram and slightly below fard. But the ruling is still the same. Technically, the ruling is still the same. Right, which means in the Hanafi madhab, if something is wajib, if you do it, there's reward. If you don't do it, there's sin. Same like fard, right? And makruh tahrimi in the Hanafi madhab means that if you do it, it's a sin. If you avoid it, there's reward. Same like haram, right? The only difference is the matter of evidence. To end today's presentation, I want to discuss something which I feel we really need to learn as a community. It's an approach to fiqh, right? This is like when the ulama go to study usul fiqh, the teachers will first teach them the correct heart and the mindset that the Ali must have in approaching fiqh. And the approach, there's different approaches that different people have, but the approach I'm going to use is, it's called the approach of taysir, making things easy for people. And this approach, which is many ulama around the world throughout history followed, it's based on a few verses of the Quran and a few hadiths. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, when he talks about the Sharia laws regarding fasting, right, in Surah Baqarah, chapter number 2, verse 185, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala discusses the laws of fasting. And he says, you should fast. But if you are sick or you are traveling, you should make it up later. And then in the same verse, Allah says, يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ بِكُمُ الْيُسْرَ وَلَا يُرِيدُ بِكُمُ الْأُسْرَ. Allah wants things to be easy for you. He doesn't want it to be hard for you. So this verse, or this part of the verse, is a principle governing how ulama are supposed to approach fiqh. Allah wants things to be easy for people. So our job is to facilitate that. Right? Linked to that, the other verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala discusses the fiqh of hajj. Right? And he says, he did not place any haraj, any unbearable difficulty for you in this religion. Right? And the closing verse of Surah Baqarah, لَا يُكَلِّفُ اللَّهُ نَفْسًا إِلَّا وُسْأَهَا. Allah never burdens a soul beyond his capacity. All of these verses, many of the ulama looked at them together, and the hadiths that I'm going to cover in the next slide, and they said that there's a running theme through all of this. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants things to be easy for people. And we'll see in the next hadith, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, when he gives advice to the ulama, the advice is on the same lines. Right? Because amongst the sahaba, they also had ulama. Right? Not every sahabi was alim. Some sahaba were farmers, some were businessmen, some were soldiers, some were poets, and there were a certain category that were ulama, like Abdullah ibn Umar, Aisha bint Abi Bakr, Abdullah ibn Abbas, Umar radiallahu anhu. These were like ulama amongst the sahaba. And so when the Prophet some gave advice to them, it was in a similar lines. So what all of these verses show us is that Allah's intention in sending us a Sharia and sending us this religion is to make life easy for us. That's why Islam is here, to make life easy for us. So if Islam is not making life easy for us, there's a problem in how we interpreted Islam. Right? If Islam is making life so difficult for us that we can't get a job and we can't work and we can't go to school and we can't do anything, there's something wrong in how we interpreted Islam. So my approach to usulul fiqh is one of taking the path of taysir, as long as it falls within the acceptable realms of difference of opinion. And this is the advice of the Prophet ﷺ. Whenever he sent the sahaba to new areas to do dawah or to teach the new converts, and one of the hadiths he would advise them, يَسِّرُوا وَلَا تُؤَسِّرُوا. Make things easy for people, don't make it difficult for them. Teach them tawheed. When they accept that, teach them to pray. When they get used to that, teach them to fast. Make it easy for people. Don't expect someone to convert to Islam and the next day he has a big beard and he's praying five times a day and he's given up all of his vices and he's a perfect Muslim. No. Make things easy for people. Give them a path to redemption. Right? Don't try and force everything on people at once. And so, this hadith is taught to people who are studying to be ulama to teach us the proper methodology, which is make things easy for people, don't make it difficult for them. If there are two options that your ijtihad is arriving at, one makes life difficult, one makes life easy, both of them are based on sound usulul fiqh, right? Then the preference is to go with the one that makes life easy for people. Likewise, in a very important hadith, also in Bukhari, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, this religion is, or I prefer to translate, this religion is practical. Whoever makes it too difficult on himself will be overwhelmed. Meaning, if you make Islam difficult, you will not be able to practice it. And I have met so many people like this, who they tried their best to make Islam as extreme and as difficult as possible, and they burnt out. They burnt out, they stopped practicing, or they ended up leaving the religion altogether. Why? Because they made this religion so unbearable on themselves, they just couldn't follow it. Take it easy on yourselves. Right? Take it step by step. Don't try to be this perfect saint who doesn't make any mistakes. Rather, follow the path that's going in the right direction and expect to stumble along the way. So even in fiqh, we try to make things easy for people, right, as much as possible. And finally, I want to end today with one quotation, and then we'll open the floor to Q&A. It's a beautiful quotation from Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah rahimahullah on the description of what is the Sharia. And this is usually mentioned when talking about maqasid, but it's applicable to the usul al-fiqh as well. Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah rahimahullah said that the Sharia is founded upon wisdom and welfare for the servants of Allah in this world and the next. In its entirety, it is justice, mercy, benefit and wisdom. So anything which abandons justice for tyranny, mercy for cruelty, benefit for corruption and wisdom for foolishness is not a part of the Sharia, even if it was introduced through interpretation. Meaning, if a scholar's conclusion after making ijtihad is to pass a ruling that makes life difficult for people, it leads to injustice, it leads to cruelty, it leads to corruption, it leads to foolishness, it leads to problems in society, his conclusion is wrong. Because that's not what Allah wanted for us. Allah did not want things to be hard for us. Right? So if someone passes a fatwa, and he bases the fatwa on Quran and Hadith, but that fatwa makes life so difficult, you can't live. You literally can't live. And there are so many fatwas like that, you know. We have people making fatwas like, you can't go to university. You can't go to school. You know, fatwas like, you know, you can't own a credit card. I mean, these fatwas are based on sound usul al-fiqh sometimes. But they go to a level where life becomes impossible for some people, right? Because some people literally, if you don't have these things in your life, you can't do your business, you can't work, you can't travel, you can't do certain things without these things. So ulama have to look at things from different perspectives. And so when a scholar works in the field of fiqh, he has to look at his conclusion and ask, is this just? Is this merciful? Is this beneficial? Is this wise? He has to ask himself all of these questions, because if any of those questions is no, he came to the wrong conclusion. If any of those questions is no, he came to the wrong conclusion. There's something wrong in what his conclusion is, because this is what Islam is. This is what the Sharia is. It is justice, mercy, benefit and wisdom. Right? So as we go through the history of fiqh and the principles of fiqh, you will see how they all work in this direction. And with that, we come to the end of today's presentation. I'm going to open the floor to Q&A for maximum 30 minutes. So what we're going to do is every week, we'll start at 7:30 on the dot. This week, we started 5 minutes late because people were still finding the place and finding parking. From next week, we start 7:30 on the dot. And we will finish at 9, latest 9. Right? I'll do from 7:30 to 8:30, and then after that, open the floor to Q&A if there's any questions for the next 30 minutes. And if there's no questions, we'll close off earlier. But I want questions. Right? I said, if there's no questions, I want questions. I get very bored when there's no questions. So please challenge me, wreck my brains, tell me I'm wrong. I love all of that. I love questions. It's starting to say.
Two comments rather than questions. I think in the beginning you said the resistance from the traditional ulama for ordinary people to learn usul al-fiqh.
Yeah.
And I think just in the overview, you can see why. You know, it's... They're being threatened by people getting this understanding and challenging.
It's true.
The last slide about ease and the difficult part.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the opposite, where people feel you're more pious and more righteous if you choose the difficult part.
It's a very good point. Okay, so you mentioned two points. The first point is that some ulama may be afraid that if you study this, you'll challenge their opinions. My reason for wanting to teach this is that you find the right ulama to follow. That'd be blunt as possible. You find the ulama who are applying these things, not the ones who are just memorizing books and parroting them. Right? So it's up to, again, the average Muslim has to follow an alim. There's no way about it. You can see how complex these fields are. Right? The point is, are you following an alim who knows what he's doing, or someone who just passed through the D and sees in his report? You know? So yes, some ulama will be challenged, that's true. But those ulama who know what they're doing, who study the religion properly, who teach it properly, who are confident in their knowledge, they won't be challenged because they're following this themselves, right? So this will help you to find out, okay, who's the right alims who I'm supposed to be following, the ones who are actually applying all of this. And that will help you in life better. The other point he mentioned is, and this is very true, not just in South Africa, across the globe, a lot of people think when you become pious or religious, You know, the more difficult you make your life, the more pious you are. And I have no idea when this idea was invented, but it did not exist in the golden age of Islam. You go back to the Abbasid, the Umayyad's time, this idea never existed. Nobody in that time was making life unnecessarily difficult on themselves. Even the Sahaba. If you look at the Sahaba, they lived such a balanced, relaxed life. You know, in terms of, they were religious. Some of them were millionaires. Some of them were businessmen. Some of them were poets. Some of them had their vices, which they asked Allah for forgiveness for. You know, they weren't this idea that, you know, the only people who are pious are those who are perfect. They didn't have that ideology. And they didn't have a lot of things that we, for example, make difficult on ourselves didn't even exist in their times. And just to give you an example of that, in the time of the Sahaba, they wouldn't have had this idea that only men can attend a lecture. You know? Or men and women in the lecture, they have to be in separate rooms. Rather, the masjid of the Prophet ﷺ had the men in the front and the women at the back with no value in between. Right? But nowadays, we're more pious than the Sahaba, right? So we've got to take it to the next level. And, you know, many other issues are like that. So the issues related to money. Some people think to be pious, you have to be poor. There was only one Sahabi who believed that. Abu Zar al-Ghifari. And Usman radiallahu anhu banned him from Medina because of that belief. He was making life too difficult for the Muslims because of that belief. No other Sahabi agreed with him on that. Usman himself was a millionaire. Right? And here Abu Zar used to clash on this every day. Abu Zar saying, you know, it's haram to save money. It was actually Abu Zar's opinion. It's haram to save money. Can you imagine if you follow that today? Can you imagine if you want to make religion as difficult on yourself as possible? Imagine if you follow Abu Zar's opinion. It's haram to save money. Which of us will survive?
He's the first communist in Islam.
Yeah, they actually do say that. I actually read a book written by a communist quoting Abu Zar calling him the first communist in Islam. So people actually say that. But the point is, even the Sahaba had their mistakes, but the majority of the Sahaba took a balanced approach to religion. Money, work, family time, all of these issues, they were far more relaxed compared to what we have today. Where it got strict was in the past 400 years. It started during the Ottoman era, the second half of the Ottoman era, what we call the decline period of the Ottomans. That's when things started getting very strict. And it kind of like got stuck there for some people. Other people managed to get out of it, but a lot of people got stuck in that strictness. But if you actually go back 600, 700 years ago, that strictness never existed. So this idea that we have to be like ridiculously rigid, you know, like I actually posted about this on Twitter the other day, that if your practice of Islam is making you harsh and cruel and mean and difficult to deal with, you don't understand Islam. Right? Because it's supposed to be the opposite. Islam's supposed to make you a nicer person. Right? It's not supposed to turn you into the scary guy who the whole world's afraid of. So that's a very good point you mentioned. Any questions? Right in the back. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned qiyas as well as ijma. What about the other two terms? That sometimes have difficulty in understanding this
islam. Okay, so that will come to in the last lecture. Right? So the last lecture, week number 6, we can discuss those terms which people have a difference of opinion on. And those terms, you have to understand all the other ones first before we come to it. So once we do Quran and Sunnah in week 3, Ijma and Qiyas in week 4, Urf in week 5, by the time we get to those terms you mentioned, like Istishab and Istihsan, it'll be a bit more understandable. But if I try and explain it now, you won't be able to understand it now. You have to understand all of that first before we can answer that question.
Come back to the makruh tahrim.
Yeah.
For example, I'm just talking about cigarette. I'm not a smoker.
Okay.
For instance, the patient went and he went to the doctor, right? And he developed a cancer to his lungs.
Mm-hmm.
He died in that case.
Yeah.
So in that
scenario,
yeah. What happened? He passed away because of the cigarette, which is what we can fit in that case.
Okay, are you asking me to pass a fatwa on his death itself? Or, by the way, one of my teachers believes.
What I'm saying is,
yeah. Okay.
What is the scientist?
Yeah.
If he died.
Yeah. Cigarette, okay. What about someone who has diabetes and eat a lot of cakes and die?
I'm just talking about
cigarette. Okay. What I'm saying is that it's the same case. Yeah. One of my teachers, his opinion actually is that if someone is smoking. And he knows he's going to die from it, and he keeps smoking, that teacher might actually consider it to be suicide. He considers it a form of suicide. I don't agree with that, but that just shows you, I mean, you can't really come to that conclusion by following his principles, right? I believe that our bodies are an amanah from Allah. And we're responsible for what we put in our bodies. And Allah has prohibited alcohol, He has prohibited any substances that are harmful to our bodies. And we know now through science that the cigarettes, the harms outweigh the benefits. Now when you come to the maqasid and the qawaid, you learn, anytime the harms of something outweigh its benefits, it's haram. Right? That's why I'm of the opinion that smoking is haram. Now, is it a major sin or minor sin? It's a minor sin. It's a very, very minor sin. You cannot make it a major sin because the major sins are those things which are in the Sharia. Those things which are clear in the Quran, clear in the Hadith. Anything else is a minor sin. Right? So the major sins are very few. They're like, the ulama have difference of opinion between 10 to 40 sins. Everything else falls under minor sin. So, minor sins, Allah forgives us for them based on our other good deeds. But, you know, my honest opinion on the issue of smoking is the scientific evidence is so overwhelming, it falls into the category of things which are harmful for our bodies, for the protection of our health, protection of our honor, protection of our life. Allah's going to ask us what we put in our bodies and what we did with it. Right? So that's why I believe it's haram. Right? So Allah knows best. But, you know, I mean, the fact that some of my teachers actually believe it's suicide, that shows you just how a big issue it can be. Yeah.
It's considered to that category.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Just to ask another question, I just want this one to stretch it a bit further.
Sure.
If cigarettes were only harmful to the person smoking it and there was no passive smoking harm, so only the person inhaling it was affected, right? Would that make it any different than the fact that cigarettes, it's not just the smoker, but obviously you are literally causing harm to everybody else who's inhaling that.
So the principle of fiqh is you can't harm yourself or anybody else. So it's not just for anybody else, it's about yourself as well. So in the same thing, for example, if someone is very sick and the doctor tells him that, you know, if you eat this, you will die. In that situation, eating that becomes haram for that person.
My other question was this one for you, so maybe by the end of 6 weeks, now with artificial intelligence, for example, IBM Watson in the legal field, or even now some programs in terms of reading scans, radiology, they say if you input enough data into the system and with the new with artificial intelligence, you can actually generate your, obviously, legal maxims or whatever. Will there be a time when all of the input is put into an artificial intelligence program and the program can then
make it shihad for us? So you're saying, will there come a time if we can trust share Google? It's actually a good question. I have to think about that. So his question is, with the advancements we have in AI, is it possible in the near future that the AI can do our HDR for us? I'll have to think about that one, honestly. It's a deep one. Actually, I'm going to take a week to think about it. I'll get back to you next week on that one. Okay. And I'm going to ask some of my teachers about it. Okay. Any questions from this side? Only half this half is interacting, this half is quiet. Any questions? Okay. Any more questions this side? Professor? You have a question?
No questions, comment.
Sure.
Can I?
Yeah.
Okay, I think the problem we're having primarily is refusing to acknowledge difference of opinion.
Yes, sure.
And it's causing tremendous problems in the community in various ways. First of all, the halal issue itself. It becomes such an issue because if I invite Yusuf, when he does not eat MJC stuff, he only eats senna.
Yeah.
He'll come to my house and ask me, which was a example. I know brothers who do not eat as a brother's house because they're not sure from where the certificate is. Very serious. Okay, that's one issue. The issue of travel, suffering.
Yeah.
Okay? The Jama'at itself.
Okay.
So, once I went to a funeral in Roshni, and on the way back we stopped at Harry Smith, so a whole lot of us made Salah. Now, this person had never heard in his life that you could actually join.
Okay.
And he was arguing. So we said, no, doesn't matter. We don't want to do it, but it is permitted. So what I'm saying, why don't the ulama inform people that, look, it is permitted. Maybe different madhahib, but as long as it falls within the madhahib, there is not a problem. But what has happened is people have, some of the ulama, possibly, have turned a law and a principle. So they're treating laws as principles.
Yeah.
And I think that is one of the problems. So I think
I actually wanted to discuss that as well. I noticed sometimes if someone passes a fatwa and a few years later someone passes a different fatwa, people accuse him of changing the Sharia. It's not the Sharia, it's someone's opinion. Someone's opinion is not the Sharia, right? That's why the first thing I taught today was the difference between fiqh and Sharia, because a lot of people don't understand this. Now, when we study the history of fiqh next week, this point will come clear. Why is it that some ulama are so strict on following the madhab on every issue, even when the hadith is clear? Why other ulama are open to taking from other mazhabs? When I study the history, we're going to discuss this, because our history went through phases. The beginning, we were very open-minded, then they went through a middle phase where people were very close, and then they went through a phase where there's different approaches came about, and we're stuck in that phase, right? Where there's different approaches, and we haven't really come to an agreement yet. But when they study the history, it makes sense why we went through these phases, why we are where we are, and what exactly we are stuck on. And I'll make my approach very clear when we study it, inshallah. So that's next week. Next week, inshallah, we will look at the history of fiqh, a brief overview. And when we do that, it will become more clear as to why we have this tension amongst ulama. And do we stick to the mazhab, or do we make ijtihad as well, or what do we do? The history will make it clear, right? And just spoiler alert, the alim whose opinion I follow on that whole issue is Shah Wali al-Dihlawi, right? The great scholar of India. Anyone who's aware of his writings, I've taken his approach on that issue. So when I discuss all the different approaches that came up, that's the opinion I'm going to be going with on how to handle the madhabs. So yeah, that's about it. I think we're done. We have one more question. Yeah.
If you don't mind, I don't know how strongly you feel about it, but would it be possible for you to make the slide?
Yeah, I'll arrange it. I'll arrange it.
Make the slideshow available for you?
Yeah.
Sure, Muhammad will organize it for you. Okay. So. We also plan to make this entire series available on YouTube in video format. So you can always go back and rewatch the videos to catch up on anything that you want.
The slides will be available on our website, the slides.
The slides?
That's why I'm here.
Yeah, he'll put it up on the website. I'll put it up on my YouTube channel.
You WhatsApp it to us to all.
You WhatsApp it to us.
Don't understand.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, basically, Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. This is the introduction after the session. First of all, I think the Zafran Hussein for accepting the invitation and coming. We didn't know how this course was going to go. We discussed it about a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And it took us a while, unless someone was special on me, I don't know things. So, anyway, Ismail came again about a couple of weeks ago and said, let's get it. Bismillah, let's start. And we just initiated the first, what do you call it?
Thematic
Quran. Thematic Quran in the Quran about 3 weeks ago, where we're taking one, taking thematic Quran, for example, and every month we're having a session on one of the surahs, which takes about 30 months or so. The idea is the culture of learning and studying Islam in the community in Durban is extremely weak. For some reason, I don't know why. Go to Cape Town and there's a cause happening almost every weekend, every week, something is happening. Joburg may not be as much, but at least Durban is just lost. So we felt that, we have a halqa here weekly as well. The idea of the center actually was started for the same purpose of having these discussions, learning, teaching, etc., etc. And I think this course, we've had so many other sessions, but there's like a weekend session or a one-day session. But I think on a more regular basis, learning is not taking place. So this is one of the reasons which motivated us to start this program. Secondly, I think, I'm going to quickly go through the, I don't think you had a chance to do this, let me just do it quickly. Okay, so this is quickly the motivation. The curriculum would be, this is what we've done today. The overview of Usul al-Fiqh, which will take us 6 weeks, according to Ishaq Ismail, right? So this is the 6 weeks. I'll come back to books, etc., course notes, and so on. I'll come back to this now. The second one is a tafsir. Again, this is basically an overview again of tafsir. So he's got about six topics so far. Hadith science, that's a much more, very wide subject, obviously, doing only overviews, he's not going to go into details. Second, Islamic history, I'm not sure exactly which part of history you want to do, but I think he's put some ideas
now. I want to do a summary, the book, The Lost Islamic History, summarizes the entire history of
exactly.
Islam.
Exactly, okay, good, book. That's right. Good. Second, and of course, there are other topics which we put down. On spirituality, tazkiyah, dawah, aqidah, in fact, there's lots of other things. And of course, like he explained, I mean, you take Makassi, it's itself another 6 weeks program.
Yeah.
Whether we want to do that or not, I don't know. But I mean, it's up to us to decide, okay? So this is basically the overview. And I want to put down some presenters. I mean, we're kicking off with Sheikh Ismail, but there could be other people that we need to look at. So you as the first cohort or first initiators of this group, I think your feedback will be useful in the way we actually manage this program. So let me go to some of the things that I want to talk about. First of all, notes. The PowerPoint presentation, in fact, I had a discussion this morning. Well, now you understand why. Okay. That notes are very important. And I think if we want to make this, look, we did this program, just to give you an example. We did this whole day in a day with Sheikh Limu. Okay, this is very much detailed, and I gave him a copy of the book. Okay, so, okay. Okay, so the idea was basically, but how many of us ever went back to check and to read and study and basically internalize the knowledge? I don't think we're doing enough of that. And I'm hoping with this course that Ismail is starting off, that we'll get the notes, we'll read around the subject, and there are books, for example, the one on Maximus. This is so important. We should have it in the madrasa level, seriously. I believe the Maximus should be something better, because that teaches you how fiqh has arrived. I give one example. They say, you know, I'm selling books. And some people tell you, if it's got eyes, I can't buy it. Right? I said, but where is the usul of that? Am I right? There is no usul of it. Because you have to understand the principles. Where is the usul? Anyway, the idea is, this is how fiqh has become complicated and actually is messing our lives. And I think you're right. It's really messing our lives. Okay, so notes, books. We have some books. We have a few of this available. I think what once you... Okay, the other thing you didn't do was to register. How many of you registered online?
How many
people
in difficulty?
Yeah.
What happened?
I don't know.
I told you there was
about Mikhail.
Yeah.
You see, Mikhail, test it, okay? But we got it right in the afternoon. Nobody complained. Some did complain. And then we test key effect.
I could.
And then we tested it, it worked. So I don't know what happened. Anyway. But anyway, what I want you all to do is that we haven't registered yet. I want to go home tonight and register online, because then you become the recipients of all the notes and everything else that you're going to do, notification, etc. I prefer it online, email, whatever. Mikhail, go do that. Good. Resources, we talk about books, we talk about, and I think other subjects as well. In terms of logistics, is Monday night good enough? Are we happy Monday night? Okay, 7:30 for 6 weeks, then we take a break and then we reconvene the following year. The other topic we'll talk about online now. Oh yes, do you want to have a examination?
No.
Come on, guys. No. Okay. This way. We did online, right?
Yeah.
Okay. We did online voluntarily. How's that? Come on. I mean, you know, you're not going to learn.
I don't want the exams. I call it test yourself.
Yeah, you could.
Test yourself.
Yeah. Okay.
Tick a box.
Yeah. Tick a box. Okay, right? True and false. You know what? Exactly. I tell you why. Because that reinforces learning. And you do, we kind of saw them and discussed with Ismail during the week how we'll set up something with either Moodle or whatever it is. We'll make a plan. Simple, easy one. Put it out there, and you know what? You test yourself. I think it's very important. The one that you didn't mention today, maybe next time, is Mandub as well.
Yeah.
I didn't see that anyway. It's free, okay? I'm happy with free. Too cheap. Okay. What we'll do is we'll just charge you for the notes and that sort of thing, because remember, my office runs it, we do the back end, etc. So there's a cost. But as far as Ismail is concerned, this is his fee submitted in our service. Okay. So, any questions? I'm happy with all that. So please, if you register, I'll send the notes tomorrow. Okay? Don't register, it's your problem. It's on Hikmah of Surgery. We're using Hikmah because of all the facilities in the back end are on Hikmah. So Hikmah of Surgery. This course is being provided by three groups of people. One is Islam Care
Self-Help.
Self-Help. That's his business section. Islamic Forum has the... one of the protagonists of this idea of learning and learning, which is hosting it. And of course, Bedul Hikmah does all the hard work. Okay, if nothing else, books, Maxims, only a few copies left, I think. So you could go online and order that one. Which other one is this one here on Sharia? And I think
next week we're doing the history of fiqh. So Dr. Bilal Phillips spoke on the topic, the evolution
of
fiqh.
We don't have copies of that. I think I'll be working with him and say if we can possibly in advance get books, because please go and read. You should be reading every day of your life. Okay? JazakAllah
khair.
Yes,
Asha. Really
enjoyed.
I think half
of
it was
good. Yeah. I think it was very good. Yeah.
Presentation
studies
very interesting. And very captivating.
Actually,
and inshallah, we look forward to others. And it's nice to see Malana Mucho. I know he's a good boy. He can contribute so well to
the community. He's not a monarch, Asha. And I think Ismail has got a good style. I think keep it simple, and I think the idea is basically. Secondly, lastly, maybe, sorry, just invite others. I mean, look, 21 of you came. Gender balance, mashallah, 10 and 11 is fantastic. Okay? But please, from I think it's a fantastic program. And I can already imagine other things that you're going to do with other speakers as well, and we could do something in detail. So, JazakAllah khair. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.